Welcome back to the Teach and Coach GA podcast. I hope you're having a great week. I want to apologize for my voice. I've been sick, maybe 3-4 weeks ago, and I just can't seem to shake a little bit of a cough and all that I still have going on. I wanted to go ahead and get this episode up and running and published. It's a little bit different episode. It's really geared more for my family than it is for anything else. But I did want to go ahead and share it with everybody else because I think as teachers, we also could use this idea, use this process of recording with a family member for our students, have something for them that they can look back to in the future that would be beneficial for them. I also want to apologize for some reason in all my time recording this podcast, my audio has always been good. I learned a lot when I recorded the Atlanta Sports podcast years ago now, I guess, maybe 2 years ago. And we had lots of audio errors there, and I sort of learned my lesson, and audio has been good here, but somehow I must have done something wrong because my audio is not great. So I apologize about that. Apologize for the voice and the cough you'll hear occasionally, but I do hope you enjoy as we dive into a little bit of Bark's family history.
Welcome back to the podcast. Joining us this week is not an educator, although they have taught me quite a bit. They're not an administrator, although they have laid out quite a bit of discipline upon me in my life. We're going to go a little bit different this week, and this is really a show not just for listeners, but also really for my family in general. My family now and my kids when they get older. And I'm sitting down to record today with my dad. So Jeff Barks is here to join us. Dad, welcome to the show.
Nice to be welcomed.
So, again, before we get into this, I do want to apologize. I was sick like 3 weeks ago, and for some reason, what stuck around is still a cough and a little bit of a weird voice. So, to people listening, I apologize for that, but we wanted to go ahead and try to get this recording done and knocked out. It's important to me because we're going to talk a little bit about family history, actually a lot about family history. And if you're a teacher, I really think it's a cool assignment for your students to look at in the future of sitting down and recording family history with your family. Those are things, you know, paper sort of an old school way to do it. The chances though of that paper surviving is slim to none. But if you can have your students record audio with whether it's parents or grandparents to get some of that family history, that stuff, recorded audio can really last a lifetime. So I encourage you to maybe take a similar approach with your kids, have them record some of that family history. And without any further ado, we'll let you listen to a little bit of Bark's family history. So, Dad, I guess let's start with who were your parents? Like, what were your parents' names?
Arnold and Grace Barks.
All right, so Arnold and Grace. What was Grandma Barks's maiden name?
Hall.
All right. Do you remember... I guess you probably definitely remember. So who were your grandparents? So you said Hall over there.
That was Tom and Marguerite.
Okay. And then on your dad's side, who were?
Rose and Leonard, where you get your middle name from is my grandfather, Leonard Barks.
Okay. All right. Beyond that, do you know of any... Do you remember any other Barkses beyond that they talked about, or?
It's my Uncle Reg.
But he's your dad's brother, right?
Correct.
Okay. How about beyond Leonard? Do you have any recollection of them talking about anybody beyond Leonard and beyond the Hall side?
Unfortunately, no.
No. And Leonard was already here. He didn't come from England, right? He was in Canada.
Leonard came from England.
Oh, came from England. Okay.
He was hired to be a master bookbinder for the Federated Press. And he was a St. John's Ambulance trainer. And he was referred to as Doc Barks at the Federated Press. The Federated Press was an establishment that was in Montreal for many, many years. And bookbinding was a lot different then than it is now. Of course, that's all automated. Yeah.
But so he came, he actually came from England. So he was the first Barks here
yes,
from England.
came with my dad, Arnold.
Oh, wow. Okay. So your dad was born in England as well?
No. Well, actually, yes, he was born in England.
Okay.
Making me remember things that I haven't recalled.
All right. How about on the Hall side? So, excuse me, on the Hall side, were they in Canada already, or do you know if they immigrated?
Well, they immigrated from Hull, England, and were in Quebec. And the funny thing was, Tom Hull was an artist, and he stayed in Canada briefly with my mother, and then went back to England, and my father and grandfather were immigrating from England to Canada. And so they were like ships crossing in the night. And Tom Hall eventually returned. And settled here in Quebec, in Canada.
And he was the artist, right, who was, if I'm remembering family stories right, he was a really, really accomplished artist and was asked to join, is it the Group of Eight?
The Group of Seven, A.Y. Jackson, Tom Thompson are two of the names. And if he had not been such an arrogant Englishman, it would have been the Group of Eight and I'd be a millionaire. And so would you. His paintings were equally as good and in the same style as the Group of Seven.
Yeah, so all those paintings we have around the house would be not just household paintings, they'd be valuable pieces of art.
Indeed, they would be. Yeah, he, a bit of a funny story about him, he didn't believe in taxes, and he never paid a nickel of taxes in his life. Everything was done with cash money. He would paint scenes, hunting scenes, fishing scenes that he had actually been on himself, with an Indian guide. And I remember a birch bark canoe that was on the property was falling to bits, but I still remember it. And when he got to be into his 80s, the Social Security people finally figured out that this man hadn't paid any taxes. And his response was, can't hear. What'd you say, young man? Can't hear. So he went to his grave without paying a nickel.
That's pretty. I don't think you could go that long in the United States and not pay taxes. They'll track you down a little bit quicker.
Right.
So let's go to your dad. What did your dad do when you were growing up? What was his profession?
He was a commercial artist, and he couldn't go to war because he had a weak heart. He'd had scarlet fever as a youngster, and he had a weak heart. But Uncle Reg, his brother, went to war. He was an engraver, quite a talented individual.
Where did your dad work when you were growing up? Do you remember where he worked?
He worked for the Ciba Company, a pharmaceutical company. He had his own company, A.L. Barks Advertising Designers, and he had the Kraft Foods account. And my sister's teddy bear decorated Kraft Foods peanut butter jars for many, many years. And that's a little story aside from what you normally hear about how teddy bears and pictures of logos and things get put on things. Well, that was my sister's teddy bear.
That's great. So the Kraft Foods peanut butter years and years ago was created by him using a little teddy bear in the house.
Yeah.
That's fun.
Always had plenty of Kraft cheeses because there were always samples to be had and so on.
Did your mom work at all, or was she did she stay at home?
She was a stay-at-home mom. There were four children, my brother Randy, younger than me, and my sister Valerie and sister Connie.
What did y'all's house look like growing up? Was it where did you grow up in multiple houses? Were you in one house? What did What did
we started out on Green Avenue in Montreal. We went to Ottawa, 38 Kinnear Street. Now, don't ask me why I remember the address, but I was only about six or so when I left there, but I remember that. My brother was a character. He used to sleep on the road in the summertime because it was warm. And much to the horror of my mother and neighbors, who would think this kid was sleeping in the road, couldn't believe it. He had a little wagon, and he was raced down the hill in a wagon to go across a busy street between the cars. It's amazing he survived his childhood.
So what the first house, is it, are these standalone houses or these townhomes?
I don't remember my first home, Green Avenue. I was just a youngster. 38 Kinnear Street was a part of a duplex. And then we went back to Montreal to McLean Avenue in Montreal. And then from there, we went to 15 Cedar Avenue in Pointe Claire, that we were there for 25 years.
And that's where your home was next to a school, right?
Yeah, I was only late once.
You were only late once? I thought the story was you were late often.
No. I used to pick snowball fights with the kids from school, and we had snowball fights all winter, and that was great fun. I developed quite a throwing arm. I won a medal at a school Olympics, I guess we'll call them that. I was 12 years old and beat the 18-year-olds who were in senior high.
So in school, did you play any sports or anything in school?
Played a little baseball and a little basketball, but nothing really organized. I could have been a good pitcher, because I could throw a heck of a ball.
Yeah. How about academic-wise? How did you do academic-wise?
I was not a very good student.
Good enough. The video is not being shared here, but a big grin went across his face as he says, I was not a very good student.
In high school, I excelled at drafting and woodworking, working with my hands.
So what did your mom and dad, what were their thoughts on school? Was it talked about? Was it pushed on you? Like, hey, you need to be doing better at this, or was it just, hey, graduate?
The latter. They figured that schools knew what they were doing, and they didn't. My dad was a workaholic, and my mother was busy raising children.
Right.
And they weren't big on education. Figured that the school would do the job.
Do you remember how Randy and Valerie and Connie did?
Yeah, they did all right. I mean, we all did okay. All became gainfully employed.
I guess that's what really mattered afterwards.
Yeah, we left the nest and survived.
Right. So after high school, What were you looking at doing? I know you end up going to the Navy, right? But in the Canadian Navy, did you have other things you were thinking of? How did the Navy thing become the direction you took?
Well, let me think. I guess before I joined the Navy, I worked for my father as a photostat operator, making pictures and so on and enlarging things for his business. And I guess I was hadn't decided what I wanted to do, and the idea came, join the Navy and see the world.
Yeah.
And so in 1963, September, I joined the Royal Canadian Navy as a sonarman. I was to chase submarines.
So what was the name of your ship? We'll start there.
The first ship I was on was HMCS Outremont, which was a World War II frigate and had been in action in World War II at Omaha Beach, I believe. And she had up and downers, triple expansion steam turbine piston engine. And it was supposed to have steam turbines, but the Germans sank the ship that was bringing the engines to the Outremont, and they put anything in they could find. And consequently, the ship had a maximum speed of about 17 knots, which for a warship was dead slow. Yeah, I almost lost my life on that ship. I was in a force 12 on the Beaufort scale, and that's when the waves are 30, 40, 50, 60, 100 feet high, and the waves are being blown by the wind being so strong. And all the guardrails in the ship got broken off, and we didn't have a chance to stow them, and water started pouring into the squid well where we had anti-submarine mortars, and the hatch covers were on the decks sliding around, and myself and another sailor went up there as brave soldiers would, sailors would, and secured the hatch covers. But I had tied a reef knot around my waist, and the reef knot was not the right knot to tie, and it came undone. And I was washed overboard except for one remaining guardrail, and I hit it. If I hadn't hit it, we wouldn't be doing this podcast, because I would have gone overboard and they would never have seen me again.
Yeah.
You last about 3 minutes in the North Atlantic. The hypothermia sets in.
Oh, wow. That's we're lucky for that guardrail. There's a lot of Barkses and folks that wouldn't be around without that. So that's it sounds like an important guardrail.
Very important guardrail.
And all right, so you're after that ship, what ship did you move to next?
Well, I got to finish the story.
The
captain was on the bridge and could see the rope come undone and saw me slide across the deck, and he summoned me to his quarters after, and he said, "Able Seaman Barks, what knot did you tie around your waist?" And I told him, "A reef knot, sir." He said, "Well, that was not the correct knot to tie. You should have tied a bowline. You will go to the forecastle and see the bosun tomorrow morning, and you will be with the bosun until you can tie the bowline with one hand behind your back." And to this day, I still can tie the bowline with one hand behind my back.
Good.
The second ship I was on was HMCS Nipigon, which is now a reef retreat for fish in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. But when I joined her in 64, she was virtually a brand new ship. Prince Philip had been aboard her, and she was a DDH 366 and had a helicopter landing.
What is a DDH?
A destroyer, destroyer escort with a helicopter landing deck.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And what was your role on that?
I was a sonarman.
I
was supposed to be a weatherman because I on the testing that the Navy did when I first joined, I scored a perfect 100 on the test regarding weather. They had never had anyone that scored a test. And I attribute that to my geography teacher in high school, who taught college weather. And but I decided I did not want to go and play with polar bears in Hudson Bay. I would rather take the second opportunity, which was to be a sonarman. I had very sensitive ears, unbeknownst to me, but the Navy knew how sensitive my ears were.
Okay. What was your rank in the Navy? What did you enter as? What did you leave as?
I entered as an ordinary seaman, left as an able seaman, but I was an officer's candidate for a while. And if it hadn't been for going out on exercises for 3 weeks where I got very little sleep, I probably would have passed the entrance exam, and I would have gone to university and become a engineer officer. That didn't come to pass, and I moved on to other things.
So what is it? So you said you entered as a seaman and left as an able-bodied seaman. What is the
Well, ordinary seaman, that's the bottom of the rank. That's like a private in the Army.
Okay.
And then able seaman is the next rank up. And then you have leading seaman, petty officer, chief petty officer. And the first ship I was on, the Outremont, was infested with roaches. And roaches just became a way of life. And we looked at the ones, and the little ones, we called those ordinary seamen. The big ones we call chief petty officers. We killed them.
that is good. So did you sign up originally? Was there a certain amount of time you had to serve in the Navy? Did you serve
first,
one?
The first hitch was 3 years.
And did you serve 3 years and that was it? Or did you?
Yeah, I did 3 years and then I left.
Okay. So after you get out of the Navy, what was the next step for you? What did you do after that?
Well, I worked for Canron, a electric motor manufacturer, a big company. Worked there for about a year. And I worked for a Kingsway Transport as a junior mechanic. Didn't last long there. Then I joined Air Canada on April 17th, 1967. As an apprentice mechanic, and I was with Air Canada for 20 years.
So during that time, I know your first marriage, were you married when you were in the Navy or when you got out of the Navy?
When I got out of the Navy.
Okay. All right. And what was her name?
Jennifer.
Okay. All right. And so married to Jennifer, we have Kristen Phillip. My brother's Kristen Phillips, so for people listening, they don't know who that is, but for everybody else in the family, we do. Kristen Phillips come from there. And so you join Air Canada. At what point did you meet my mom?
Janet was an answer to a prayer. After my unsuccessful marriage of 14 years with Jennifer, I was looking for someone to take care of my children, who were foremost in my mind, to get a stable environment. And unfortunately, the environment with Jennifer was not conducive to raising good children. And I prayed about your mother and had certain stipulations that I wanted to put on the arrangement. And it was basically to make sure that I got the right one. And all my prayers were answered. I flew 100,000 miles before I married her, or close to it. I lived in Montreal, and she lived in St. Petersburg, and I flew back and forth many, many times. Can't count how many times.
Yeah.
For 2 years. And
So y'all get married. She moves up to Canada.
Yeah.
I'm born in Canada.
Yeah.
What made y'all decide enough of this Montreal, enough Quebec, let's get out of here and go to Georgia? How did that conversation go?
Taxes, weather, and politics. Taxes, for give you an example, I had a sign-on bonus for signing a new contract with Air Canada, the union did, and it was a $1,000 bonus check. I saw $393 after taxes.
Oh, wow.
And the other thing that pushed me away from Canada was Canada's didn't have the intestinal fortitude to stand up for what it believed in and could do. The Avro Arrow comes to mind. And Avro developed a jet fighter in the 50s that was equivalent to a modern day F-18 or F-14 Tomcat. And that was back in the 50s. And this was a threat to British aircraft industry and a threat to the American aircraft industry. And with a stroke of a pen, John Diefenbaker, the Prime Minister of Canada, ceased the existence of the Avro Arrow program and put 20,000 people out of work. And a friend of mine, Bill Gordon, was there and he said, you know, we left work one day, came in the next, and the doors were closed, and we were told we could collect our toolbox in a couple of weeks, and the Avro Arrow was no more.
Yeah.
I was very disappointed in my country that it would capitulate so easily. And the people that had developed the Avro Arrow formed the nucleus of the group that put the man in space for the Kennedy Space Center. Those engineers were Canadians. A lot of them joined NASA.
So how about, was the language thing a part of it? Because in Quebec, in the 80s, right, we had the big issue of you have to speak French and everything's French signs and French everything, and we spoke English. Does that contribute as well?
Well, I got tired of the rhetoric. You know, everything had to be French. The English couldn't be recognized as a language. I couldn't put a sign in front of my house saying Jeff Parks Machine Shop Services. That would be contrary to the wishes of the Quebec government. And it would have to be in French and French only, or French and a very small English letter.
Yeah.
And it was not a good thing. It was unfortunate for Canada.
How did y'all pick, right? Mom is from St. Pete. She's from Florida. You're in Quebec. How did y'all decide if you're leaving? How did you decide Georgia's the place to go?
Well, I drove from Montreal until Miami in August before I joined the Navy. And I came through Georgia and looked around and said, this is a lot like Quebec, but I know they don't have winter to speak of here. And Georgia stuck in my mind. And when we decided to leave Canada for the States, Georgia was the place for me.
Was it hard for you to get into the States as a Canadian citizen, if I remember?
It was right, difficult. It was a lot of hurdles to be jumped, and they weren't going to allow me entry, even though I was married to a U.S. citizen. That was difficult, and it took the threat of a lawsuit to the immigration people by my father-in-law, Eddie Daniel, Janet's father. To allow me to come into the country. And there was all sorts of testing, medical tests to be done, and quite a procedure. It took 6 months to complete. Today, of course, if the southern border is any example, they don't do anything like what they did with me.
Right. So we talked a little bit about your brother before, and I'm guessing this is around the time frame, and we don't have to talk about this if you don't want to, but and I can also, you know, edit anything you'd like me to edit, but is this around the time frame your brother passed away when you moved to Georgia, or he passed away prior to this?
I gotta think now. No, we had moved to Georgia and he was still alive.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you know roughly how old he was when he passed away?
In his 40s.
Okay. I can vaguely remember as a kid getting cards from him that were like old Jeeps and like military trucks kind of things on like sort of postcard type stuff from him. I vaguely remember that as a kid, but other than that, didn't know much about him. Do you want to talk at all about what he passed away from, or what, you know, if y'all were close?
Well, that's
growing up and.
Yeah. Well, we were brothers, and brothers fight. And he threw a fork at me once because I pestered him and it stuck in my arm. I was bad for pestering him. He died of AIDS, which was unfortunate. He made a life choice that was not the best one to have made. But he took care of you when you were a baby.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, he did. He was a very loving brother. but he made some mistakes. And unfortunately, he's no longer with us. Otherwise, you would have another uncle.
Yeah. All right. So y'all get down here to Georgia. What did you do from there? You were in Air Canada up there. Air Canada, I'm assuming, didn't have a lot of jobs in Georgia.
No, I wish I could have transferred to Georgia, but that was not able to be happening. When I first arrived here, I worked for Air Atlanta, which was the first black-owned airline, and I was there for 4 months, and they went under, which was sad because I would have had a good position as that airline developed. Then I was in the forklift business for a while, working on forklifts as a mechanic, and then went to a forklift company, Ren Handling. I worked there for 18 months, 2 years. And then I signed on with Northwest Airlines and was with them for 5 years and developed some equipment while I was there. I built the first landing gear changer while I was working for them, and I also built pressure washer system for washing airplanes that saved Northwest Airlines $100,000 in 6 months. And the company that I was working with, Pure Corporation, hired me away from Northwest Airlines, and I was with them for a number of years. And they were bought out by Ren Handling, Zepp Chemical, and was with them for a period of time as well before I left on my own and started my company, D-Check Developments.
I remember you working with Northwest. I remember us flying as a family and having to get dressed up to fly. I remember them confiscating my rubber band shooting wooden guns that shot rubber bands. There was no TSA at the time, but whoever searched our bags thought that was an allowed weapon for a 7-year-old to take on a plane. But so I remember the times at Northwest. I know that at Pure you were sort of stuck in an office. Is that, you know, sort of stuck in an office? Do you look back and wish you had stayed with Northwest longer before starting your own deal, or do you feel like that?
Well, I think I left. I left at the right time because it was downhill after I left. Company was not doing well, and they closed down Atlanta and shifted a lot of people to Minneapolis, and then they laid those people off. So it was not a good thing. Delta was probably the best thing that could have happened to Northwest.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about D-Check. So this is modern history now, right? Where you're still with D-Check. Talk to us a little bit about sort of what you've done at D-Check, what you've built.
Well, I was I was working for Northwest to develop a piece of equipment to change landing gear because the system they had was very crude and dangerous. And I walked up to an airplane, a DC-9, looked at the landing gear, stuck my arm out and said, I need something that can pick up a landing gear like my hand and then have all the motions of my hand and body to be able to put this landing gear on the aircraft to remove it. So I with those concept in mind, I drew up what is now the OmniArm and built it out of material I found around the airport. And that was the first landing gear changer that Northwest had that was really a professional piece of equipment. And it made it possible for two men to change the landing gear. And I believe that machine is still in Minneapolis. The second machine went to AirTran Airways. This was a lot more sophisticated than the first one. There was a different methods of bolting it together, and they loved the equipment. They had an aircraft that did an overweight landing, which meant that all the landing gear had to be replaced, and they shipped the machine from Orlando, where it was being used, up to Atlanta and had a professional crew come in to change the landing gear. And they suggested that I go over and show them how to use it. And by the time I got there, they'd already changed the three landing gear.
Oh, wow.
And remarked on what a cool machine this was. And they said, whoever designed this really knew what they were doing. And I said, well, you're looking at the guy that designed it. So
what do you credit your, you know, you said you weren't a great student, you were good at drafting and good at woodworking. What do you credit your talents for being able to sort of develop this? Was it something you learned from your dad, from somebody else?
Well, I learned woodworking from my dad, and mechanicking just came naturally to me. I built a go-kart when I was 12. That had steering and suspension, and would do 30 miles an hour. And I worked on cars and learned how to weld, and just grew with the trades. I had a Vincent motorcycle, which needed to be rebuilt, and I learned to machine, I learned to weld, I learned about painting, I learned about plating. Learned about all these skills, and then when I joined Air Canada, I picked the brains of everybody that would teach me something as far as what I wanted to do with my motorcycle. And that's held me in good stead. I drew all the parts of the Omniarm, and when I was working for Zep, I wanted to learn to do SolidWorks, but they said, you can draw quicker and better than someone with SolidWorks. We're going to keep you at, and it was true. I did very good at hand drawings with all the detail, and that allowed me to have a full set of drawings for the Omniarm to make all the parts. And Delta was a customer, still is a customer. And I've got Omniarms all over the world. The new Bombardier, which is now the Airbus 220, I developed the Omniarm to do that landing gear removal installation. And that's now the equipment that is bought by the airlines to replace landing gear.
Okay.
Boeing used my equipment on the 737NG. To do a fixture installation on the wing prior to the wing being attached to the aircraft. So every Boeing 737NG is built with a device called ELMO for electric mobile lift. And I have 17 of those machines running 24/7 at Boeing. So I'm very proud of that. That a guy with a high school graduation certificate was able to build equipment for Boeing aircraft.
Yeah. So as we look to wrap up, is there anything that you wish I would have asked you that you would like to have said, hey, I wish that you'd asked this, I wanted to talk about this or share this? Is there anything?
No, nothing comes to mind at the moment, but it will do when we hang up.
All right, and then last one then for you from me is for grandkids listening to this 10, 15, 20, 30 years from now, for their kids listening to this to learn more about their great-grandfather, what is something you would like them to know about you or any advice that you would give to them?
Well, I'd give them some advice. Learn as many skills as you can so that you're able to change trades according to what is out there. Invest in yourself with your education and give whatever project you take on, give it your all. Do it with the idea of doing it as good as you can, not just to get away with something that's partly there. Give it all you got. And that in the Navy, we were pulling ropes aboard ship. We used to say 2-6 heave, which means give it all you got. So I would say to my grandchildren, who I may not meet, 2-6 heave. Give it all you got.
I think that is good advice. It's similar to what I tell my students of basically the best of what you're capable. If you always do the best of what you're capable, you can never hang your head. So I think that is great advice. I've never heard that 2-16. That might be a new, I'm going to have to remember that.
2-6.
2-6.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, go ahead, Dan.
That's in your side of the family, as far as your grandfather and Pinky.
Yeah.
They say 2-6. Uh-huh. That comes from the British. I have one more story to tell you.
Yeah.
We were issued rum every day at 11 o'clock, and the bosun would pipe up spirits, hands to muster for grog. And we would all line up with our cups with Coca-Cola or water, and we were given 2.5 ounces of rum, 180 proof. It was referred to as Nelson's blood for Horatio Nelson. And the reason why they had rum aboard ship was because the conditions that sailors lived under at those times was so horrendous that the only way they could survive was on rum. And,
You know, you mentioning that, Dad, made me think of one other question I had for you. So, just so that people know listening, some of your health things that you've gone through in your life, and to me has always been impressive that you never complain or, excuse me, never complain or get frustrated. You may do it privately, but some of the health things you've gone through between, you had cancer, I remember when I was in, I guess maybe early high school, and then Parkinson's here that you've dealt with over the last, I guess, maybe 5 years now, and then prior to that, or post that, your heart attack. What do you think has allowed you to keep, you know, as positive an attitude and keep going, pushing through the things you've had to deal with?
Well, I don't know how to answer that. I guess it's just what I do. I can't see crying over it. It's a reality. You got to deal with it, and you're better to do it with a smile on your face than to be down in the mouth. I survived stage 4 melanoma. That was 20 years ago. I'm fixing to survive Parkinson's disease, be the first one that does it. And the heart attack hasn't got me yet. So I'm giving it all I got.
That is a good way to end it. Well, Dad, thank you so much for taking time to join and share some family history. Hopefully even those that aren't a part of our family that listen will take a lot away from it, enjoy it. But thank you, Dad. Love you, and we'll chat soon.
All right.
Well, there he is, the man, the myth, the legend, my dad, Jeff Barks, joining the podcast this week. Thank you again, Dad, for taking the time to join us, and really looking forward to others being able to take a listen, and I'm sure I'll get some texts from family members that say, that's not how it was, it didn't go like that, but that is okay. Looking forward to hearing all those stories and responses from family. And for the teachers listening, hopefully you enjoyed, you know, the perspective of somebody else and hearing their story and the things that they accomplished and went through in their life. And maybe it's something you can look to do with your students so that they can build a little bit of a family history that can actually stick around. I remember doing like a family history tree as a kid, but it was on paper and there's no way it still exists. It's got to be in the trash can or wasting away in some landfill somewhere. So audio that we can record, maybe post somewhere on the internet for these kids to be able to track down the future, something that could actually could be used later on down the road. So hopefully it's something you take a look at using. For all of you that are listening for the first time, if this is your first time listening, thank you so much. I hope you'll consider subscribing. You can do that on your favorite podcasting platform. And maybe take a few minutes and write a quick review about what you think about the podcast. That helps others track us down as well. Thank you so much for listening, and look forward to sharing with you next week. Music from bensound.com and called Sunny.